Hello, you're listening to Wine Blast, and this episode's a bit different because it's all about wine books. And in case you're thinking that's potentially a bit dull, here's just one quote of many we'll be featuring. Service is service, and you need to treat people well, whether you're serving them a salad or a sex toy.
Hang on.
It's good enough.
Hang on. We are talking about wine books here, aren't we? I haven't accidentally wandered onto the set of My Dad Wrote a Porno.
No, that is a bona fide quote from a bona fide wine book written by one of the wine world's most respected figures, who we will identify in due course.
Well, so I guess don't judge wine books by their cover.
Indeed.
It's the first lesson we're learning.
Yeah, no, I know some people say books, and wine books in particular, can be boring. And that is definitely true for some, but certainly not all. And in this episode, we are heroically helping save you from the drivel and instead pointing you towards the stuff of dreams.
The stuff of dreams. Wow. You're setting the bar high here.
Don't we always? Indeed.
Yeah.
But I think we should probably give some context to start off.
Okay, good. That's my cue, isn't it? Right. Yeah. So this episode was inspired by an article in a well-respected publication, which shall remain nameless, but it's not a wine one. And this article was picking the best books to get to grips with wine.
And it made you cross. We can safely say it made you cross.
I might be overstating the case a little bit.
I think it did.
I think whatever we're saying there, let's park that. What I would say is it just got under my skin. It really frustrated me. Partly because, I thought it wasn't a very good selection for the purpose. But also because I know a lot of people read and trust this nameless publication. and so it's sort of letting them down,
so,
in a way.
So in essence, the publication was wrong and you knew better.
No.
Yes.
Maybe. Don't look at me like that. But, you know, it's more about the fact that, you know, as we all know, wine can be off-putting and intimidating. And most people, let's be honest, only have a certain amount of time they can give to wine before they lose interest or they switch to something else. Fair enough. But equally, you know, I'm profoundly aware of how much joy wine can bring. And not just wine itself, but reading about wine too, you know, immersing yourself in the joys of the subject. So I guess the fairest thing to say is it got me thinking, you know, what would I recommend? And it was a very different lineup.
Yeah. And then of course, we chatted this over. Me, the not-so-keen reader in the family, who always is trying to cull and trim our vast book collection as it takes over every single shelf in the house. Me, who at one point couldn't stop laughing on holiday when I realised you were reading some tome on quantum physics and I was reading 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
Remember?
I remember that.
I'm not so sure that sums us up.
Either of those titles quite made our long list today.
No, I should hope not to. So we wanted to come up with a selection to appeal to different tastes and interests, whether you're an enthusiastic beginner or a jaded expert, and books that would cover different bases. Really just a concise, user-friendly list of wine books we feel every wine lover should own.
Yeah, so we racked our brains and our bookshelves. And then, of course, you know, we jumped onto social media to see what everyone there had to say.
Which was actually really interesting, wasn't it?
You know, it really, really was. So thank you to everyone who joined in and recommended their all-time wine book favourites there. And then we started the long process of reading and rereading, buying any books we didn't already own, arguing. Definitely came
apart
in.
The fact you were buying more wine books.
Well, partly, but, you know, we did also make a point of registering our pet hates as well as what got us most excited. That was interesting. We probably argued some more about that. We definitely laughed. There may have been some tears. We definitely drank.
It was long drinking.
As a result of this process. And then we probably argued some more after that as well. So, you know, you get the picture.
We can't even remember, can
we? That's
the
process. Yeah. That's a rigorous process.
And along the way, we had to ask ourselves quite tricky questions, most important of which was, what makes a great wine book? Now, this is quite personal, but for me, it's a book that inspires me to love wine even more. And not just in terms of making me reach for a specific bottle, though I do love it when that happens. Also wine books with a story that has some facts and information, things that I can talk about and tell people.
You know, I agree with all of that. You know, you absolutely put your finger on it. You know, what makes a great wine book is that it inspires you, you know, in whatever way that is. It's a book that sort of manages to go beyond the subject, isn't it? And engage you, touch a nerve inside, you know, make you feel something. I mean, it's sounding a bit self-helpy, isn't it? But
it's a bit. It's a wine book.
It's something that nourishes you. You know, I suppose it is like a good wine in a way, without making the trite comparison. It should intrigue as well as inform. It should make you think. It should maybe challenge or shock you. Above all, it should get you talking and sharing, like you said.
And I think that the best ones also have a sort of timeless appeal, don't they? Even if wine books tend to very easily go out of date. And I think a focus on people or personalities always makes for the best stories.
Yeah,
but anyway, enough of the theory. We want action. Remind me how we're going to do this.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, after much debate, let's just leave it like that, we've chosen our six best wine books. They cover a range of categories or styles. And within those categories, we'll give shout-outs or honourable mentions to other books worthy of your attention.
This is going to be controversial, isn't it? I can feel it coming.
Maybe, but you know, let's not prevaricate here. Let's not beat around the bush. I reckon this is definitive. This is the definitive wine book list, you know, and anyone who disagrees is just wrong. Plain as that.
It's good to know we're retaining some humility here. That said, we have nobly overlooked our own efforts in this field. Not that our books would really be contenders anyway.
Our own meagre efforts. you know, but none that we've written to date anyway. Let's not undersell ourselves here. You know, until maybe Wine Blast the book appears.
Oh, now there's a thought.
That's just going to change everything.
There's a thought. We also have a few wines to taste as we go along, which tie in thematically. Good excuse to have another drink. Mm-hmm. Because all the best book clubs surely are mainly about the drinking, aren't they?
Absolutely. There we go. Right. So who's going to start? Come on.
I'll start. Okay. I'm going to go right for the jugular.
I'll start drinking, you start with the
books. Start drinking, I'll start talking or keep talking. And I'm going to go for the jugular with the World Atlas of Wine, 8th edition by Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson. I'd say if you only owned one wine book, it should be this one. I mean, it's not cheap. It's about £40, but it's absolutely crammed full of detail, an opinion, analysis, facts and figures.
Yeah.
And that's partly down, I think, to the fact that this book first came out in 1971 and all the revisions since have just honed the formula and then updated the content with each new edition.
Yeah, yeah. It's an absolute classic.
It really is.
And actually, I think you mentioned 1971. I think you can still buy that original 1971 edition for about £20.
Really?
Yeah, I think I saw that on Amazon. But anyway, you know, if you want a bit of history, there you go. But no, we use this on a daily basis, don't we? And that's a sign of a good book.
Yeah. So this is our reference or academic category. Yeah. And it's important to note that this isn't just the work of one or two people. Mm. It's a huge team of regional experts who come together under the sharp eyes of managing editor Jill Pitts and assistant editor Julia Harding.
Mm.
Didn't you contribute once?
Yeah, I did once. I think on Chile.
Chile?
I think it was just once. Yeah. It was a while ago, though. All I can say is that Jill and Julia are two of the loveliest people to work with.
Yeah. But it's not just also just the regional experts, which you were. There are all kinds of experts contributing. So you've got Patrick McGovern on history, Greg Jones on climate change, Alex Maltman, who we recently had on the pod on geology, Matt Thompson on winemaking. So, you know, many of these people have written their own books on their specialist subjects. But here you can find all their knowledge in one place. So that's partly why I say, you know, it's the one wine reference book that you need to own.
One book to rule them all.
One.
Just like the one wine glass to rule them all. But I think that might be for another pod.
Possibly.
I have to say here, I love, adore the maps here. I mean, I think there's something like 230 of them.
Mm.
It's incredibly hard and expensive to do good maps in wine books. So this is a real treat. And they just bring wine to life, don't they?
Yeah.
You can see on the page why wines taste how they do. That's amazing. What? Are you laughing?
You and your maps. They are great. But it's not just about the maps. At the beginning, what I like is, you know, there are these incredibly useful sections on things like the history of wine, grape varieties, terroir, climate change, geology, pests and diseases. Mm. There's the vineyard year, you know, how to make wine, oak, corks and other seals, aging wine, appellations, labels, tasting and discussing wine, serving wine, economics. You know, it goes on and on.
I'm going to stop you there because I think I need to lie down. I think you need to lie down after all that. I certainly need to lie down. There's also, just looking at the back, there's also a really good index and gazetteer. I never quite know how to say that, but you know, both of those things, versions of those, they're quite rare.
I mean,
they cost a lot of money to put together.
They do. I mean, no sane publisher would touch this kind of project these days. I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of groans with the weight of accumulated knowledge and detail, attention to detail.
Yeah. So what about criticisms of this Oof. Book? Hard, but you know, you could argue it's a bit francophile or europhile. You know, France gets 100 pages, Europe as a whole gets 238 pages, but the whole of the New World only gets just over 100 pages.
I suppose that is arguable. I mean, I guess they'd say they try to reflect where the most interest lies. You could map everywhere on the planet, but this is already a big book. You've got 420 pages. It weighs over 2 kilos. One other thought, actually, it might be worth waiting for the next edition, which looks like it's due out in 2025, I think. And in this eighth edition, which is the current one, Jancis actually says that wine, and I quote, is in greater flux than I have ever known it during my 44 years writing about wine. Mm. And she cites things like natural wine, social media, indigenous grapes and global warming in this.
Yeah, I think the blurb is quite interesting here. The first edition of the World Atlas of Wine was a publishing landmark when it appeared in 1971. It married the clarity and precision of fine cartography to wine and its pleasures for the first time. The result, the book has been translated into 15 languages, sold 4.7 million copies, and is recognised as the most authoritative and essential guide to wine geography ever published.
And
it's probably sold more since then as well.
I think it probably has. So you do get all the classics, but also places like England and Wales, Georgia, Israel, Turkey, Brazil, Japan, China, Black Sea, and the Caucasus. Yeah. I mean, interestingly, Ukraine is described as an ethno-political hot potato, and this was published in 2019.
That's really interesting. There's some great turns of phrase as well, aren't there? Things like, if Paris is France's head and Champagne her soul, Burgundy is her stomach. And another one is, 200 years of generally unfriendly attention from Russia would be enough to put most countries in conformist mood, not Georgia.
Anyway, it's a 50-year masterpiece, wouldn't we say? Everyone should own it. Now we need to move on. But before we do, I think a couple of honourable mentions in this reference category. Mm-hmm. One is the Oxford Companion to Wine, the latest fifth edition of which has just been released, hot off the press. Right. And I went to the London launch last week. It's an unbelievably comprehensive A to Z of wine and definitely, again, worth owning.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd also throw in things like wine grapes. You know, it's a biblical level take on grape varieties. And Wine Science by Jamie Good. It's essential reading for lots of wine students.
Before we stop? I'd like to champion one other, actually, which is referenced, but aimed more at beginners, I'd say. And that's Wine Folly, The Essential Guide to Wine by Madeleine Puckett and Justin Hammock. Mm. It's easygoing, very visual. It's an introduction to wine fundamentals, grape varieties, regions. It's original. I think it's very engaging and just beautifully simple, really.
Yeah. And I've just picked it up. If you could see us, the scene here, we're surrounded by a sea of books.
We can't move.
And I've just picked this one up. It's quite easy to spot in the crowd. It's not a big book. It's very visually different, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's almost the opposite of The World Atlas of Wine. So if you find that intimidating, maybe go for this one first. It's kind of an infographic approach to wine, isn't it?
Definitely.
They've also got a good website and social media, haven't they? So you can check those out first, see if you like it. And if you do, this book's well worth.
And it's useful. It's one of those books useful. It's got bits on how to identify wine faults, how to write tasting notes. It's got advice on glassware and decanting, food and wine pairing. Mm. I mean, it's even got maps.
Maps. Music to my ears.
I know.
You had me at maps. Anyway, time to move on. From reference to history. And I'm going to bring conflict into this discussion even more than it already is by plunking Wine and War by Don and Petey Cladstrup very firmly onto our list. Now, the Cladstrups are American journalists with a deep knowledge of France, and this book recounts with great skill and sort of narrative tension the experiences of some of the greatest winemaking families in France during World War II. To set the scene, it opens with the dramatic moment when the French army are blowing the doors off Hitler's private stash of looted wine in a mountain fortress high in the Bavarian Alps. And within lie untold wine riches.
There are some amazing stories in this book, aren't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, there really are.
But they, the authors, claim this isn't a wine book, don't they? Or a war book, for that matter.
It's quite right. They say it's not a wine or a war book. It's instead it's about people. People who exude wit, gaiety and good taste and whose love of the grape and devotion to a way of life help them survive and triumph over one of the darkest and most difficult chapters in French history. But I'd argue this is very much a wine book, hence inclusion on our list, because it's all about the sort of coming together, the sort of brutal collision of wine and war. It doesn't mean it's not about those two things. It's about how they come together. And these things, when you think about it, are total opposites. You know, wine is the most peaceful, the most sociable thing you can do. It brings people together. And this book, if I have to sum it up, it's a sort of hymn to the value and joy of wine, you know, and wine people. And along the way, you learn so much about wine, history and people and places.
Yeah, I tend to hate conflict or violence in books or films for that matter. Mm-hmm. But this one doesn't seem to glorify that aspect. It's more about the sadness of war than the violence, isn't it?
Yeah, I totally agree. That's really well put. You know, it also feels like an important book, you know, a sort of necessary book. The authors describe it as a race against time to hear these war stories from old wine growers before they died. You know, it was published in 2001. I think. And it's clearly the result of painstaking research and sensitive retelling. It's brilliantly readable and so intriguing.
And there are some pretty stellar names in there, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. It's like a who's who of
French
wine families.
It really is.
Huet, Drouin, de Nonancourt, Hugel, Rothschild, d'Angeville, de Vogüé, Tattinger, Lure Salus. I mean, all the big names. And it just tells some absolutely fascinating stories, like hiding resistance fighters in wine barrels to cross the demarcation line, or fobbing the Nazis off with poor quality wine, or siphoning off barrels from wine trains bound for Germany.
And it was it was wine shipments that actually helped inform Allied intelligence too, wasn't it? So when a large order of champagne was put in for a certain foreign destination, they'd know a major Nazi offensive was about to be launched and the wine was meant as a reward for the German soldiers.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was the case with Romania and with Rommel's campaign in Egypt. And you do learn some intriguing stuff, like the vine Führers, the wine Führers, you know, something I never knew about. But these were the Germans put in charge of securing wines from France, often at knockdown prices, so they could be resold at a huge profit to fund the Nazi war machine. But this wasn't a straightforward tale, because these wine Führers, you know, had been wine merchants before the war, and they knew these French producers. So often, you know, these people, they try to tread a fine line between appeasing their Nazi overlords, but also not being too harsh on the French. And it's an intriguing story how that plays out in Bordeaux and Champagne and Burgundy.
So there's a bit of a heartwarming angle there too, isn't there?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean,
to some extent.
The book
bittersweet.
Also, yeah, it starts with the Frenchman saying that wine isn't just a beverage. It goes to the country's heart and soul. It gives us courage and hope. Now, I feel like I should be doing this in a French accent, but I don't want to come over all allo, allo and just completely base the feeling here. So I'm not going to do that. But you have to imagine the French accent. Now, one quote runs in the same context. We know our land was here before we came, and it will be here long after we're gone. With our wine, we have survived wars, the revolution and phylloxera. Each harvest renews promises made in the spring. We live with the continuing cycle. This gives us a taste of eternity.
There are some lighter moments as well, aren't there?
There are.
It's a bit intense.
Well, it always comes sort of slightly with a tinge of sadness in this book. For example, you know, they tell the story of a magnificent book written during the war about the best wines and foods that Roger Ribot could dream about having. And it gets published after the war and sent to his comrades, you know, which is lovely. But the catch is, you know, he wrote it amid the horrors of a concentration camp. There's also a good poem which sort of captures this ambivalence, which I'm just going to read out here. God made man frail as a bubble. God made love. Love made trouble. God made the vine. Was it a sin that man made wine to drown trouble in?
So it's a mixture. It's a mixture of sadness and positivity or hope.
Yeah. I mean, this was a horrific chapter in French history. You know, the bit about at the end about collaborators is pretty hard-hitting too, you know, including wine collaborators. Did you know that 160,000 French people were brought to trial or investigated after World War II for collaborating with the enemy? And 7,000 were condemned to death. Women had their heads shaved, men were shot, old scores were settled. You know, and some wine people were accused of collaborating, which the book touches on. But, you know, amid all this, wine itself endures. That's the positive message here. And you read about remarkable human resilience and how wine people saved Paris and Bordeaux from being blown up. As the Nazis retreated, you know, and the epilogue ends on a happy note, or a hopeful. It's not probably not happy. It's hopeful note too.
So one of the moving book. Maybe one to enjoy with a glass of good champagne, like this. We have.
I'm just going to do my refill.
So it's Mum 2015 vintage, which is tasting beautifully succulent and broad, isn't it? It's a really lovely Pinot based style that I'm enjoying quite a lot. Good.
I was just captivated with the wine and the label. Just looking at it now, 2015, obviously that is what, 70 years exactly after the end of World War II. So this is actually quite
How appropriate. It was a bit accidental, wasn't it? No, we absolutely intended that. But yeah, just going back to this category, we could have mentioned quite a few books in this sort of history category. Hugh Johnson's Story of Wine, Empire of Booze by Henry Jeffries, Oz Clark's History of Wine in 100 Bottles, books by Patrick McGovern or Rod Phillips. There we go. But right now, it's time to move on. So coming up, we have fiction, food, France, fraud, and the odd sex toy. So far on our list of all-time great wine books, we have The World Atlas of Wine for reference and Wine and War for history. Next up, we're travelling around France in the amiable company of Californian wine merchant Kermit Lynch with Adventures on the Wine Route, a wine buyer's tour of France.
Now, we talk about classics, but this is a classic, isn't it? It's an all-time great. Originally published in 1988, but we've got the 25th anniversary edition here, published in 2013.
Yeah.
I have to confess, though, big confession, this was not in our library. We did not own this book.
We say it's a classic and an all-time great. We didn't own it.
That's why I'm owning up. You know, we had to buy this after doing our social media survey because so many people recommended it. And I'm glad we did because it blew us both away, didn't it?
It did. I mean, it also helps you understand a whole sector of wine books, wine bars as well, wine merchants, wine producers even, because it is clearly, you know, it's been so influential. Lots of people have jumped onto this bandwagon, as it were.
And it's a sort of spiritual bandwagon. Before I start blabbing, we should say what the book is all about, shouldn't we, and what the bandwagon represents.
Good point. So we follow in this book, we follow wine merchant Kermit Lynch around France as he tries to find wines to buy. It's a very personal account, and that's what makes it so interesting and fun. You know, Kermit is delightfully opinionated and cheerfully iconoclastic. He likes his wines old school. So we're talking elegant, thought-provoking, authentic, terroir-driven. But he's writing in the 80s at a time when new fashions and trends are for wines to be big, winemakers to be interventionist, and the old ways are being forgotten.
Yeah, and this, of course, provides much of the tension and the humour.
Absolutely. So he says things like, "More and more, I feel as if what I am operating is not a business, but a preservation society." You know, he rails against wine scores and blind tastings. He praises elegance in wine and hates the opposite, saying, And I quote, "Rejecting a wine because it is not big enough is like rejecting a book because it is not long enough or a piece of music because it is not loud enough." These big modern wines, in his opinion, assault the palate. It hurts to drink them.
I think you should be doing this in a Californian accent.
Well, you didn't do French, and no, I'm not going to do Californian. But no. He says that people who like them are not wine lovers. They are status seekers. And then by contrast, he says of a 1954 Latache, "I will never forget that wine. Light as a snowflake. It was sublime at 31 years of age." So he likes thirst-quenching wines with, as he says, a gaiety to them. Wines that have finesse, balance, personality and originality.
In praise of snowflake wines. I love it.
I like the idea of it.
There is one quote I've got here, which I found, which I adore, and that is, "Wine is, above all, pleasure. Those who would make it ponderous make it dull. They want it all there in one sniff, one taste. If you keep an open mind and take each wine on its own terms, there is a world of magic to discover."
Magic, yeah. And I think one of the many things that makes him so appealing as a writer is he never overdoes it. He's fundamentally unpretentious in so many different ways. And he's so quotable.
Yeah.
You know, you want to print out his mantras on huge banners and hang them all around your house. You know, things like, and I love this, you know, "Syrah without a hillside is like St. George without a dragon. Boring."
Where does he come up with this stuff? He's funny too, isn't he? You often find yourself bursting out loud laughing. I mean, he says of one misguided Loire producer, "That horse's ass ruined my Sancerre." He writes of a tasting a wine so atrocious, it smelled like vinegar with a bit of complexity from the plastic. And then he writes, "Beaujolais should not be a civilised society, lady. It is the one-night stand of wines."
Anyway, so this entire book is a cri de coeur, an impassioned plea for authenticity in wine. He calls it a crusade on more than one occasion, doesn't he? Now, many people would say, you know, what he's arguing for is natural wine. And he does use that term, but it's a bit more nuanced than that, I think. You know, he does champion what he calls living wines in contrast to wine robots rolling off the assembly line.
And he was writing this in the late 80s, wasn't he? Which is sort of before the natural wine movement took off.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So he's ahead of the curve. And you could argue he was one of the original instigators of the natural wine movement. But then in the epilogue, which, as you said, was written in 2013, he makes it clear he's very far from a natural wine fundamentalist. He says, and again I quote, you know, "ultra-natural wine does not always taste good." And he criticises the true believers who in their zeal leave their palates behind. You know, he wants wine that is authentic, that tastes good, that, as he says in another very quotable phrase, it takes intelligence to make, intelligence to appreciate.
And he's not afraid to be critical or even sort of catty, is he?
No. He excoriates the INAO, the French Appellation Authorities, for being too permissive in allowing planting on poor quality land. He actually calls it legalised fraud.
Yeah, it's quite punchy.
You know, he's scathing about Bordeaux, calling it a land of facades. He says California Pinot Noir is to Burgundy what the Empire State is to Notre Dame. and that the only good thing about Chablis is the wine, because the rest is cold sheets, questionable quenelles and frostbite. He absolutely then lays into Guigal's Cote Rôties, which is pretty heretical in wine circles. He calls them over-oaked freak wines, which he says depresses him.
And funny enough, you know, we loved this book so much that it inspired us, or you unilaterally, to be honest.
It was me, wasn't it?
To crack open a bottle of Cote Rôties.
We've got it here.
Talking about Cote Rôties. So, yeah, exactly. This one's in our glasses.
Yeah.
The 2011 Bernard Bourgault. Because you can only read so much about amazing old school French wine and not be dying to dive in.
Yeah.
And this is the most wonderful bottle. It's talking about magic. Yeah. This is magic. Isn't it?
It's just gorgeous, isn't it? It's meaty and funky and elegant and brilliant with food. And so I'm going to say only the best books move you to open great wine. So I am blaming you, Kermit, and your wonderful book. But in short, it's a must read, you know, several times. You learn so much. You feel inspired to wave banners, crack open bottles, you know, argue with a Frenchman. It's brilliant.
It is brilliant. But it's not perfect.
No, no. I mean, well, it's definitely dated. You know, the wine world has moved on from 1988. I mean, for one thing, he casually sort of recommends comparing a Tempier and a Chateau Margaux. Virtually no one can afford to do that now. You know, also he's... One thing he's crushing about Beaujolais, saying Beaujolais has everything a wine-loving tourist could desire except good wine. But, you know, this was at a time of industrialisation of Bordeaux when it was hard
Beaujolais.
You know, when it was hard to see beyond those oceans of Nouveau. I mean, it's so different today, isn't it? It's been revived. We covered this in our episode on Beaujolais. And to be fair, he does cover this in the epilogue. You know, at one point he says, how wrong I turned out to be.
Yeah, but I mean, even the epilogue is a bit dated now, isn't it? You know, Robert Parker is no longer the most powerful man in wine. Mm. There is a brilliant bit where Lynch, he sort of recounts how Parker called his newsletter colossal bullshit.
Yeah.
So Lynch asks him to publish this as a review, saying anything Parker calls colossal will sell like hotcakes.
I love the fact the colossal bit. I mean, it's just...
colossal.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, and occasionally he does take sort of growers' views on contentious issues at face value, doesn't he, a bit too much. And there are also some, I don't know if you would agree, that I've sort of found some slightly outdated, possibly sort of slightly sexist views in there too. Is that fair?
Yeah. But then, the story that starts it all off, featuring a winemaker, his wife, a horse and a gun, is surely one of the best ways to start a wine book. We need to move on.
Yeah, we do.
Now, this was the regional sort of / stylistic category, and we could have recommended literally hundreds of books in here, couldn't we?
Exactly, and that was the problem, so that's why we didn't. So we'll just rattle off a few we like and use. The Christie's World Encyclopedia of Champagne and Sparkling Wine, all 800 glorious pages of it. I'm not going to try and lift it up because I'll give myself a hernia. The Sumptuous South American Wine Guide by Amanda Barnes. Inside Bordeaux, Inside Burgundy, we've had those on the programme. Lots of the Infinite Ideas, Classic Wine Library series, they're very useful.
Then there are things like Natural Wines by Isabel Legeron, Alice Firing's book, The Battle for Wine and Love, also about natural wine. Amber Revolution by Simon Wolfe, and we'll be coming on to that one in another episode.
We will. Brilliant. Okay. So three to go, and we will speed up. My next choice, I've got this one here, is The Billionaire's Vinegar. I don't know why I feel like I should show. I'm holding it up
You're showing me it, aren't you?
The Mystery of the Mystery of the World's Most Expensive Bottle of Wine by Benjamin Wallace. And this is about the sale of a 1787 Chateau Lafite at Christie's Auction House in 1985 for $156,000. This is just one bottle. That's about £105,000. It was the most expensive bottle of wine ever sold. A Bordeaux first growth from a historic vintage etched with the initials THJ. So logically, Thomas Jefferson, the wine-loving third US president, which was miraculously discovered in a bricked-up Paris cellar.
But things weren't quite what they seemed, were they?
No. And you get a great... The cover jacket of the book has a great picture of this bottle. Yeah. It's quite something. This is a story about fraud, greed, deception, ego. It's not in things you usually get in a wine book, which is why it's quite good. It's a bit of a detective story, really. And at its heart is a shadowy character known as Hardy Rodenstock, a German former pop band manager turned wine collector extraordinaire. The man who claimed to have unearthed this unicorn wine with impeccable timing just before the 200th anniversary of the year the US Constitution was signed and also of Jefferson's visit to Bordeaux. So cue lots of celebrations and things to show off.
Yeah, and things are never proven beyond doubt, are they? And obviously we don't want to give away too many spoilers for those who haven't read it, but the accumulated evidence by the end is overwhelming, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, as you say, we're not going to give the whole thing away, but let's just say that the billionaires and nuclear physicists get involved. Legal judgments are pronounced. Both sandpaper and a dentist's drill come into play. There's even a guide for how to fake old fine wine. And along the way, you get these brilliant little side stories, like how this very bottle is put on display in a museum under a bright light, which dries out the cork, which then falls into the bottle, effectively making it the most expensive bottle of vinegar ever. Hence the title, The Billionaire's Vinegar.
I suppose it's also a slightly sad story in that it's about the loss, if you like, of wine's innocence. Mm, you know, wine, after all, has gone in the last 50 years from an enjoyable beverage to an investment-grade commodity. Mm. You know, it's hyped by auction houses and investment firms, paraded and, you know, fetishized by ultra-collectors, with the world's top wines now utterly unaffordable to most wine lovers as a result.
Yeah, yeah, and hence the incentive for fraud too, you know, of which, if you listen to the experts, there is a lot, you know, not just of the top stuff, but also the big brands. And that just undermines the joy of wine for everyone. I guess it also raises questions about the complicity of parts of the wine trade in this, if we're being honest. We should add that this book is hard to come by in the UK, partly because Michael Broadbent, former Christie's auctioneer who's featured in the book, sued publishers Random House, as a result of which Random House apologised, paid damages and agreed not to distribute the book in the UK. I remember chatting to Michael about this at the time and he was absolutely furious about the whole thing.
I bet he was. But that court case didn't lead to the book being changed in any way, did it? That settlement just related to the UK?
It did. It did. And I think we bought our copy before all this.
I think we did.
So anyway, this is clearly a controversial book as well as an intriguing one. It was published in 2008, but has lots of contemporary relevance and features many wine names we all recognise. You learn a lot about history, Jefferson, Bordeaux, even Alexander Hamilton pops up at one point. Though clearly, he wasn't a wine fan for many of his virtues. You can't have everything. You also learn things like what a tappet hen is. Tappet hen?
No.
A very rare old bulbous style of bottle.
There we go. Any particular quotes you'd highlight?
Yeah, I've got a couple here, actually. Lafitte was Broadbent's favourite wine. He thought Lafitte the acme of elegance, a racehorse beside the show horse of Mouton and the cart horse of Latour. And then another one about Broadbent. As befitted a top auctioneer, he effortlessly melded the hustle of a barrow boy and the self-deprecating charm of a courtier. So it's, you know, it's well written, it's controversial, it's intriguing, and it's very relevant today. Maybe read it with a glass of reassuringly cheap Bordeaux would be my recommendation.
Yeah. Even more so, given this issue of fraud hasn't gone away, I would say that, you know, it is very relevant. And another book to mention here is In Vino Duplicitas, if I can say it, The Rise and Fall of a Wine Forger Extraordinaire, this time about the fraudster Rudy Kanayawan, who was recently released from jail, actually. Hardy Rodenstock never went to jail, by the way, and died in 2018. Now, this is a good book, and there's also a Netflix documentary about the same subject called Sour Grapes.
Yeah, I'd also mention Shadows in the Vineyard, about the plot to extort Domaine de la Romanée-Conti in Burgundy by a man poisoning vines. It's a horrendous story in many ways. Top quote from that one, "Wine is the ghost of grapes." Thought that was a nice one to pick out. Anyway, moving beyond fraud, but into on other sort of narrative non-fiction, I'd also give a shout out to Starlin's Wine Cellar and Phylloxera by Christy Cam.
Yeah, and then in terms of wine autobiography, I'd give a big shout out to Tasting Victory, a wonderful tale of disaster, triumph and resilience by the late Gérard Basset, WMS, MBA and former best sommelier of the world.
It's a good misfold titles, yeah.
And it's in that book, of all places, that this most arresting of quotes appears. Service is service. And you need to treat people well, whether you're serving them a salad or a sex toy. Better?
Good old Gerard. We miss him a lot. And that's very hard to follow. But you are going to follow that, aren't you? And thinking about it, with a salad too.
You could say that. You could say that. I don't think I'll ever think about salads in quite the same way again. But yeah, my final nomination goes to The Wine Dine Dictionary by Victoria Moore, an A to Z of suggestions for happy eating and drinking. Now, this is one of our specialist fields, isn't it?
And you are one of the best cooks in the wine world, I'd have to contend.
That's very generous. I think I've got quite a lot of competition there. But we did do, let's face it, 12 years of testing out wines and dishes and recipes for BBC One Saturday Kitchen, and many years of additional food and wine matching on other TV shows. It's something we do on a virtually daily basis for work and for fun.
Yeah, that's why we don't get out much. That's why we don't have many friends left. And of course, we did do our matching food and wine miniseries on the pod, didn't we?
We did indeed. So we've essentially done a huge amount of work on this subject. So we're pretty, I think, a pretty hard audience to please, let's face it. And there are many books on this theme.
Loads.
But none, I'd say, as useful or comprehensive as this one.
High praise. You know, it's, I mean, it is a clever idea, isn't it, the A to Z one? Actually, it's sort of doing two A to Zs, isn't it? The first one leads with the food.
Yeah.
If you want to look that up, with the wines to match. And then the second one leads with the wines or the grapes, and then with the food to match that too, so you can cover it.
Yeah, yeah. So Victoria's a UK-based wine writer who studied the psychology of smell and taste. She says she's done this book like a foreign language dictionary, and it works, you know, as you've just described. What it means is you can start with the dish you're cooking or the wine you have. Works either way. And I love the way she starts by saying, this book is about the pleasures of eating and drinking wine. And also, when it comes to eating and drinking, there is no wrong and no right, simply varying degrees of enjoyment. Which I think immediately removes any of the snobbery, the pretentiousness.
Yeah, I think that's half the battle, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it doesn't just do the A to Z stuff either, does
no,
it?
No, absolutely. There's a section on taste, flavour and the brain, for example. And then some of my favourite bits are when she gets contributors' input, including winemakers who suggest dishes or recipes to go with their own wines. You know, Laurent Pilot, for instance, recommends his Premier Cru Chassagne Morichet with lobster, butter and lemon.
Ooh.
Can't think why I remembered that particular one.
So, yeah, on that note, any favourite matches from the book that you
particularly absolutely. I mean, a couple of classics are Chablis and Gougère and Nebbiolo and Truffles. But then I can never resist things like Galician-style octopus and Albarino. And I actually loved the idea of trying pulled pork and Zinnemavro. Haven't had that before.
No, that's a new one.
But there's so much stuff in there. Everything from baked beans to bone marrow. Even got coronation chicken in there.
Oh, that's my kind of book.
I know.
Definitely. Sold. So, what about flipping to the opposite? Are there any things that sort of didn't work for you or maybe sort of jarred?
Well, I suppose it's probably inevitable in a book of this scope. You know, it's quite a, you know, weighty tome. I mean, she suggests fish finger sandwiches, another one for you.
Oh, yes.
But with cheap supermarket fitu. And also blue cheese with blanc de blanc champagne. To be fair, she does suggest those in unexpected matches, but even so. She also has a slightly, what I'd say, controversial angle on fine wine and haute cuisine, saying sometimes you should just have them by themselves, or the haute cuisine with water. Now, I know what she's saying in theory, but particularly when it comes to great food, I still want to drink a beautiful wine with it, not just water. Maybe that's just me.
Yes. It did inspire you, though, didn't it?
It did, absolutely, which we've said is so important. It made me just want to open a whole load of wines to try with dishes, you know, she was recommending. I also wanted to cook dishes, you know, where the recipes are there, like hot crab pots or baked eggs. You know, I don't even really like eggs very much. And I mean, how can you resist? I've got a sentence here from the book that I can't resist. You know, with pretty much any Pomerol, it's hard not to love an unctuously rich Wagyu beef burger topped with truffle shavings. Says
right.
It all, doesn't
it? Agreed. It's definitely on the list. and we're trying a Marsillac, aren't we?
Not a Pomerol, but
it's not a Pomerol,
little bit
but
simpler.
A Marsillac.
Yeah, yeah.
And she recommends the sort of Marsillac quite a bit, doesn't she?
Well, surprisingly often, you know, 20 times according to the index, including with cassolet and roast duck, both of which I love.
Yeah, and the one we're trying here is the P&J Tellier Marsillac Leçon del Pays 2021. It's about 10 quid from the Wine Society. It's great value. It's sort of earthy, meaty, savoury, bittersweet red. It's kind of midway, isn't it? It's not super complex, but it's just definitely one for rustic
quite
food.
Rustic,
it's very digestible. It's definitely a food wine.
Yeah,
it's
you've got
a wine you know is going to get better with food.
Yeah, simple,
and
but
so,
you know, effective. You know, one other writer we have to mention in this context is the brilliant Fiona Beckett, who's published a lot of books on this subject and also has an excellent website, matchingfoodandwine.com. So do check those out too.
Yeah, very well said. So we come to the final book, and it is the drops of God. So we move from food and wine or lifestyle into fiction. And it's not just any old fiction, but it's a manga graphic novel or series of novels. So it is a bit of a cheat in the sense it's a series, not one book, but couldn't help it.
You could call them comic books, could you? Or is that disrespectful?
I mean, it gives you the general idea, doesn't it? I think manga is a bit different. It's his own genre. But, you know, this is by brother and sister creative team Yuko and Shin Kibayashi with illustrator Shu Okimoto. It was originally a comic strip in the Weekly Morning magazine, which was then published in serial book format. These things have sold in their millions. And more recently, it might be a familiar name because it's been made into a popular Apple TV drama, albeit transposing the action and protagonist from Japan to France.
Okay, I have to stop here and confess, I've flicked through these, but I haven't actually read them. So what is the story?
Okay, right. So it's a great setup. The protagonist, Shizuku Kanzaki, works for a beer company, young chap. He learns that his estranged father, a famous wine critic, has died. And in order to inherit his father's vast and extremely valuable cellar, Shizuku he's got a year to correctly identify 12 great wines his father chose, known as the 12 Apostles, and then a legendary 13th wine called the Drops of God. The twist is that he has a competitor, a young wine critic called Issei Tomine, who his father adopted shortly before he died. So the game is on, as it were.
I mean, it does sound like quite a fun concept. Mm. I mean, how does it work in cartoon form then?
It works brilliantly, actually. You know, it makes it fun, as you say, and quite funny and irreverent too. So, you know, it's very approachable. I mean, the graphic form also manages to communicate the sort of raw emotions and sensations of experiencing great wine in a way that words just can't do.
And presumably there are a lot of great wines in there.
Yeah, there are. I mean, you could say it on the sort of trophy wine side of things. So you get things like Romani Conti, Mouton 82, Henri Jaez, Croix Parentou 99, Salon 95. But, you know, equally, it does go beyond those things too. It does talk about more modest wines as well. You just end up learning a lot, you know, in a totally easygoing, sort of non-didactic way.
And it's not just about wine, is it?
No, you get fine art, you get pop music, you get opera. It dips into lots of things. It's pretty wide-ranging. It's obviously focused on wine, but, it's got lots in there. You know, I'd have to add, there is a fair amount of scantily clad, wide-eyed young women, which I understand is something of a manga staple, but just jars a bit here in the wine context. I don't know. Another point in terms of the culture clash is that it's really odd for a Western reader to read from top right to bottom left.
Yeah.
So that, but once you get used to it, it's all right. But it's just
probably
a bit
in comic format, not as bad as a normal book.
No, exactly, yeah.
But these books aren't the easiest to find, are they?
No, sadly not. You know, we must have bought them a while back because, you know, I struggled to find them anywhere in book form for an affordable price. I mean, you can get them on Kindle, but it's a great shame that the books aren't easier to find. Maybe I didn't look hard enough or you know, maybe they'll be reprinted. I don't know.
Or you can come around and borrow ours and help with my culling efforts. Please, somebody come and take
them. Open invitation. I think on that note, we should probably wrap things up, actually. Although I would just give an honourable mention in this fiction category for Peter Stafford Bowe's Felix Hart series, starting with Uncorked. It's riotously funny if you have a particular sense of humour, sort of very bawdy hijinks kind of stuff.
And I wonder who that would appeal to in our household. Anyway, this episode has gone on a bit longer than we expected, hasn't it? We hoped it would be a shorter one, but I guess these books are just too exciting not to spend time on. On which note, shall we just finally recap our six ultimate wine books?
Yeah, let's do that. They are The World Atlas of Wine, Wine and War, Adventures on the Wine Route, The Billionaire's Vinegar, The Wine Dine Dictionary, and Drops of God.
And if we were going to pick six runners-up, they would be The Oxford Companion to Wine, Wine Folly, Christie's World Encyclopedia of Champagne and Sparkling Wine, The South American Wine Guide, Wine Science, and Tasting Victory.
I'm just thinking, one thing we haven't mentioned yet is our pet hates in wine books. We did promise we'd do that. Should we do that very quickly?
Okay, very briefly then. Very briefly. One of mine would definitely be those vanity coffee table tomes, you know, that wealthy producers make, telling you how wonderful they are and how wonderful their wines are. I mean, they are just a total waste of paper, in my opinion. My humble opinion. Albeit they're quite good to perch your laptop on when you're recording a podcast. And also, yet another author-led book that claims to be the only book ever written that has the ability to demystify wine for you.
Yeah, I'd throw in poor quality maps, dodgy photos, crappy indexes, which to me just smacks of publishers penny-pinching at the expense of the reader experience. It's always a real shame. Yeah.
In terms of the bigger picture, I mean, you could question whether wine books have a future at all. You know, is it not all going to be online or social media or podcasts?
Yeah, which are obviously the way forward.
Woohoo! No, but actually, I do firmly believe there is very much a place for good wine books. And hopefully all this competition will make people focus even more on what makes books special and why. And now, obviously, we have the ultimate definitive list.
There we go.
You know, it should be easy to join the dots.
Indeed, indeed. We should add, if you, for any reason, in your misguided ignorance, think we got the lineup wrong, or you believe we've missed the best, most life-changing wine book off, do get in touch. You can email via our website, susieandpeter.com. Better still, send us a ranty voice message via the magic of SpeakPipe. We'll put that link on our website show notes.
Our thanks to all the authors for writing these books and to all of you for listening. Until next time, cheers.